You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is David Gilmore, your host for Sound Poetry. And this day, we're going to do a little different take on the interview. I will be speaking with Steve Niebel, who really was the originator of the program for Sound Poetry. But first, before Steve and I get into a good rant, I'm going to read a poem that I wrote called Headland. It's an overture. Peer Gynt, morning, overture in the air. Beyond the bluish silver surf, a grey whale of cloud cruises the horizon southward. Beneath the expanse of cream peach sky, behind the whale's tail, northward, the ocean swells, menacing, deep, green. Bathed in froth and spray, a burnt sienna headland, beflecked with gulls, rising and falling, sequentially in squealing choruses, seagulls wheeling, squealing, look, no hands, wee, wee, no hands, wee. So, we have a little bit of freewheeling to do, Steve. And it's a nice morning for it. So tell us a little bit about how you dreamed up the idea of sound poetry for KTAH Radio Tacoma.
I started sending songs to them actually pretty early on. Marilyn Kimmerling is a friend of mine, and she was involved in the station. And then they started playing my songs, and then I sent them some more songs, and they started playing those. And Marilyn had been assigned to look for content for the station, and she pointed out to me that they needed content, and it just kind of clicked into my head that a poetry program would be a good idea, and I asked her about it. And she talked to the other people on the staff at KTAH, and they said yes, and then I contacted you, and that was the best thing that I did, was getting a hold of you and having you do these interviews, David. You've been a really
thank you very much.
I don't know how it would have come out if I had been doing the interviews myself. I made up my mind to do this, so I would have, one way or the other, I would have done it. Maybe I would have gotten somebody else.
Well, I feel very fortunate myself. You know, we've known one another quite a long time, but never really done anything, never performed together. And so when you presented it, it was a bit of a dilemma for me, because I do spend time over in Idaho with quite a few projects over there. But it happened, of course, this time with the quarantine coming as a great interim for everybody, staying at home, wearing our masks, wondering if we're going to come down with a morbid croup. At our age, anyway, I'm getting on 75. You're in the 70s, right? You've done some poems, and I think you did one that was in the in light of the early masking days. Do you remember when you did that one on Costco?
Yeah.
Do you want to read one of your poems? I mean, let's read a few poems of our own as we go through this half hour here.
This is called Costco During the COVID-19 pandemic. We visited Costco the other day. There was a line to get in that was 100 yards long. It is usually a line to get out. Now that COVID-19 is here, I guess we'll all need more stuff. I saw someone with one of those big TVs come out. Then there was a truck backed up to the door. It was painted red with big black letters on the side that said, "We will be well fed through this." Then a line of people dressed in clown outfits came out of the store with carts filled with bags of rice, bags of beans, and one cart that was stacked high with balloons and a tank full of laughing gas to fill them all. I overheard someone talking about how they had seen that truck before. As a matter of fact, that tall clown with the blue nose was someone she knew from her grade school class in a small town in Wyoming. She could tell because he was wearing the same oversized shoes that he wore when he was 8 years old. It was a constant line going out. They were going out faster than they were going in. The store was so full of people that the fire marshal had said they missed the limit of occupation for the store. We didn't go in. We enjoyed our stay in front of the store, though. One of the clowns gave me his autograph, invited us for his special rice pudding dessert next week.
You love clowns. One of your very amusing songs, the Big Red Smile, Big Floppy Hat, The Clown Nose and such. But most of your songs do have a very serious note. And we've talked before about the difference between the lyric and a poem. This poem, you probably will never set it to music. But we've talked about how lyrics, some of your lyrics, for example, if you read them as poetry, there might be a diminishing, say, of the music in them as words. But when you put the music to them, even a quite ordinary line can be brightened up and given, you know, so much charm and enchantment.
Yeah, I've never really totally understood exactly how that worked. And in spite of the fact that I've written a lot of songs, I always think that it's a real accomplishment when I have written a lyric that could also be read aloud and would be successful in that regard. Most of the time, I don't think that that's the case. I think that the song is usually words and music together, and they work best together. And if I write something that I'm intending to be poetry, it's usually not intended to be a song.
And some of their lines, I think perhaps could be read on a page as very interesting in their sounds too, talking blues. But, you know, Bob Dylan, come to think of it, some of his songs do stand up very well as lyrics, words on a page that you could read. But there aren't too many. I don't think there are very many you can think of that you wouldn't want the music to accompany them.
Well, I've seen some Paul Simon songs that stand up really well without music.
That's another good example.
I really like to have something that speaks directly to people and that is comprehensible immediately, that you actually are putting images and music together and communicating a story or a thought. I really like John Prine immediately for his ability to put words and music together. He was always melodically and chordally very straightforward, very simple musically, but he had a way of speaking directly to you and you understood what he was saying.
Well, refresh me here a minute. Let's go back just a minute. I think Pam Beal should be thanked very much for helping us to get this program running and aired. She has been very gracious. And didn't you start out by putting some of your songs with Christy, the Niebles, on KTAH? Was that how you got in touch with her?
Well, no, you know, Pam has just been somebody who has been a communicator with me. She's been like the person who sent email back to me about the different shows and who I would discuss how to do downloads with. I sent her a group of songs that were Christy and me, and also there were some of Cosmos Dream, which was with Gen Obata, and she encouraged us to put together a little show with the songs and say things in between them about who we were. So she's been very, you know, just very good about encouraging us to get content to her and helpful and Because when they play things on KTAH, they don't have a disc jockey. The songs will just play. And so nobody knows who they're written by or who's performing or anything.
Unless you announce who you are and...
Right. And I usually don't. I mean, my feeling about songs is that the material should be strong enough on its own, not need to be connected with a person or a place or even a genre.
Well, they do stand for themselves. I mean, by themselves, just as a poem is to be taken in as it's read, as it's heard, so your songs too. But it wouldn't be too bad an idea to announce who you were at the end of a program of about five or six songs and say, you've been listening to the Kneebles with Gan Obata.
On the little show that we put together, we introduced ourselves and talked about each song after it played. So we did that one thing, but I have also heard those songs played. You know how we are supposed to be a half hour program, but sometimes we're 35 minutes and sometimes we're 26 minutes. And sometimes we actually are half an hour. They'll add a song or a couple of songs after we get done talking to fill in the space or,
nice.
Or maybe they'll have a whole half hour of music or less than a half an hour to fill in the space. Anyway, you know, they have to time all this stuff. I don't know how they do it exactly. They have software that does it. So a lot of times after we're done talking, they may play one of my songs or two of them.
Well, that's great, isn't it? I think you got to feel a little fortunate to have that kind of freedom and maybe surprise when you didn't expect it. But they must enjoy some of your songs to put them on, so...
You know, we're part of a community, David. We're part of a community in Tacoma, and that's what KTH is all about. It's community. It is a community radio station, and this programming is Tacoma programming, where most of the poets that we've interviewed have been from Tacoma, and we're from Tacoma. It's our hometown, and this is our radio station, and so that is a very valuable thing, and so I'm very proud to be included in the community and to be part of that.
Well, I think we've been very grateful to a lot of the poets that have come forward to read, because we have reached out to many who have resisted or gotten cold feet, but many poets are bold enough, at least during this time. Where is the audience during our COVID-19 era? You know, the audiences are harder to find. So thanks to all the poets who have joined us for an interview. And they've been very enjoyable to execute, I think. I feel quite comfortable and at ease with most of the poets. And we've had some very distinguished ones, as well as poet laureates and so forth. But all the poets have really come forward and being prepared to do their very best. And I think there's some really enjoyable programs, half an hour programs that are archived that can actually be tapped into on the website with soundpoetry as the name after radiotacoma.org. So people can tap into those periodically. But anyway, let me read another poem just to show that I was a kid once. This is from my childhood, and I know it's not good to talk about tobacco and smoking these days, but there were those days back in the mid-20th century when it seemed the thing to do if you were an 8, 9, 10-year-old kid. This is called Chestnuts. The days of acorns, walnuts, and horse chestnuts. 12 or so, if memory serves. We smoked from pipes, as clear as yesterday in an old and beautiful world. The fields, the walk through the fields, The countryside spread out for miles, far beyond construction sites and mud and rock hills, bulldozed and ready for new roads out of town. Out by the Shire farms, where the trees still stood wild, and a bull watched the file of boys tramp through its grasses. Ah, there, the house with its dark gamekeeper and his dogs. Oh, so long ago, a fairy tale. The trees, those ancient oaks that we spiked to climb when early autumn gave its sign the nuts were ripe. Old Gaffer and his dogs just couldn't grasp why we would risk to climb the oaks to join the birds and squirrels in their nests. He'd scratch his head and puff a bent pipe in his jaw and keep the dogs at bay. The sheer beauty of filching golden acorns for a pipe to smoke. At home, I'd raid the trays about the house for longish ends, even stole the odd one or two. Senior service navy cut, players with the Jack Tar picture on the packet. They smelled so sweet before the smoking. Then came the choking, horror, horror of the smoke. Hard to get used to. But there was nothing, nothing sweeter than the camaraderie of two or three bosom pals with stolen tobacco having a choke, pretending to smoke, cupping the lit end in the palm, or flailing the hand sideways from the lips, pretending to savor the smoke in the lungs, in our throats, through our noses, casually releasing it in streams. As we had seen our brothers, our parents, blowing such plumes into the foggy blue air. How important to start young in those days. To start the silent drawing of breath in acknowledged secret, forbidding togetherness in which talk was all you had, big talk, things that needed to be said together while the air was thick with unclean breath and our faces changed to new masks. And stop the clock.
My, my. I suppose that for all of us, that brings back memories. All of us who are of a certain age, anyway.
Stupid times. Stupid days.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think that that's the way to characterize it. When you're a child and you're experimenting with the world, maybe it's those who are more fearful and afraid to experiment who you might characterize as being a little bit dim somehow, because eventually when you get out in the world you have to be willing to embrace new things.
Yeah, but this was mimicking. Most of us said, you know, we don't want to be like our mothers and fathers. We don't want to do that. We don't want to be even like our brothers who have gone to work. No, we don't want to be like, but we didn't mind mimicking their smoking. We didn't mind mimicking their having a drink and getting a little tipsy.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Those pleasures. They looked so pleasurable, I suppose, that we couldn't help ourselves.
Right. That's right.
So, anyway, you got one. Have you got another one that you would like to recite? Yes. Or perform?
I think that I'll take a chance, and it's a period of time where there are things going on every day in the news that give pause for thought and images that stick in your head. We watched a documentary about John Lewis recently, although I had seen quite a bit about him over the years and read about him. This is called Ghosts. The specter of George Floyd walks beside the ghost of John Lewis. George shouts, "I can't breathe." They both laugh out loud at this statement of the obvious. They are discussing COVID-19. They stop for a moment as they greet a contingent of 10,000 walking up to greet them. People of color, all rising spirits from the hospitals, homes, workplaces where they perished in the Great Plague of 2020. You can hear the voices rising from the demonstrations back on Earth. There is still a sound of flashbangs, slogans chanted, warnings blasted through bullhorns, marching feet and breaking glass. Even now, those running from gangs, governments in ruin, climate change, a future that no longer exists, are pounded into incarceration, hidden from our view, left weeping in rooms filled with the virus as they wonder where their children have gone, if their mother still lives, what chains their father now wears. By now, everyone has heard the whispers. Now the whispers have turned to frank conversation about how to use the plague as a tool for genocide. The smiling faces of politicians on Fox News claiming that the virus is just a political plot to end the reign of tyranny, while the specter of John Lewis walks the streets with demonstrations. This time the streets continue to be full. This time we shall not allow the architects of evil to continue their conspiracy. The people continue to speak. George Floyd and John Lewis continue to walk this earth.
To the point, to the point. Yes, today also is the day that I believe that John Lewis is being memorialized at a funeral, right?
I listened to a little bit about him, and it said that he's going to be taken across the, what do you call it, Pettus Bridge, and he's going to be in different places, and then he will end up to lie in state in Washington, D.C., will be the last that his body lies. I think that it's very fitting that this country honor him long and hard. He was a man of great courage and conviction and morality.
Yes, how it takes us back. We remember some of those days of the civil rights marches and that when he was a young man with a strong voice. Well, his voice was still pretty strong even towards the end. But how interesting that with all the protests and the marches that his death comes as a great exclamation point to mark the similarity of times past and times present.
Right. I had wanted to see demonstrations of this magnitude for a long time now, ever since the 2016 election. And I've been often discouraged that people were reticent to rise up in this fashion. So in that regard, I think that the response that is in the streets right now is very appropriate, and it's a good thing that they have continued and that they continue on.
So long as the protests continue, and there's no reason that they shouldn't, with people having a lot of time on their hands in order to have their voices raised against the precariousness of our time and the dangers of our time, with so much being politicized for bad ends. There's got to be some attention paid finally, but it is so sad. I think that felonies almost have to be committed before attention is paid, or before the brickbats and the heavy guns come out. But it's the only way, it seems, in our time, just as in the past, that attention doesn't get paid until someone ups the ante.
Exactly. I often think about George Orwell and what he would think about the amount of doublespeak, that term coined from 1984. And I'm sure that George Orwell saw his share of doublespeak in his time, which is where that term must have come from. Now it has become rife in our political culture. Up is down and left is right, and cold is hot, and good is bad. And it's interesting to me how there's a portion of the population that always believes what's coming from a voice that they have decided to tie their fortune to, for whatever reason.
Well,
anyway,
you've shown that this poetry can be gotten out of this, and we have heard some good political poems of late, even through some of the poets that we're reading in the last few weeks in the interviews. But we sound like political commentators rather than poetry commentators now, as we go on to one of our favorite subjects.
One thing I just wanted to say is that when we do this show, I'm the guy who records it. I'm the guy who's in the back. But through this, I get to listen to all of these poets. As a matter of fact, I edit the shows, and so I get to hear them at least twice. Probably
right.
Three.
Well, you do a very good job.
Three times.
Right. Well, you do a very good job piecing them together and making the very best of our ums and ahs and some dead air.
But David, I have enjoyed your enthusiasm for poetry and for poets, and also your great knowledge of the huge body of poetry. There are so many different ways to do it. And there are so many different ways that it can be effective. Another thing that's really great about poetry is it's a medium that's available to anybody who knows how to read and write.
You're giving me too much credit here. The poets really do the work and are the performers. But you know what we're doing here? There's Robert Graves said, there's no money in poetry, and there's no poetry in money. Something like that. Of course, Robert Graves made quite a bit of money on translating ancient poetry, and he wrote poems and probably sold his collections for decades of the 20th century when he was a famous name. But, you know, so poets do actually want to be heard. Perhaps they want to be read. There are many beautiful books coming out during this time from small presses that are collections by excellent new poets. And I hope that we have a few more of those to interview as we go on. But let me just finish with a poem, whether or not you can edit this in. It has to do with extending oneself. It's an encounter with frogs. What is an impression worth? A frog? A jar of ruddy leeches? Oh, when I see frogs, I think, frogs are good to think. The matter of frog experience first floats, then sinks, mostly unknowable, spuriously into the spawning pond of memory. It's a rich seminal soup full of eyes, magnified, each a natural universe. These eyes are vocal ones once they spring, breaking through the skins of things, in season, everywhere, and then they're out. They're wonders of compromise. They extend themselves to bridge the poles of water world and padded land. And the extensions can be perceived from the eyes as orderly change, clear and strange, as leggy fish with iguana tails, as animals flying on all fours, fully outstretched, twice their size, jumping, climbing, piggyback, unabashedly clambering onto one another's backs, orange on orange, green on green, clinging colorfully, eyes bulging. They seem a surprise even to themselves. All right.
That was lovely, David. Frogs.
Frogs, yeah. They're still in season. I hear them chorusing at night in Idaho, in our down in the lake, the reservoir down at the bottom. Just masses of them. There's got to be millions of them croaking. And boy, what a racket they send up.
I miss them.
What a racket they send up.
I know. There's something that I always loved. Life springing from the darkness, you know. I also like crickets. There were crickets that you'd hear when we were out in rural Pierce County during the day. On hot days, you'd hear crickets, and that I always enjoyed that. The sound of insects, the sound of frogs, the sound of birds, crows in the trees. Now I live in the throbbing heart of the metropolis, and mostly I hear the sound of motorcycles and automobiles.
Yeah, sounds that give rise to various thoughts, even memories. But there is something about listening by oneself at night to frogs croaking, where it becomes a white noise eventually, but it sets the mind sometimes to reverie. Even the fact that we know we've got to be close to water, that they've gone through this transformation from jelly eggs to little swimming things and then jumping things. The whole idea of the metamorphosis and their amphibious ambivalence, it's really quite amazing. So I do think frogs are good to think. And whatever their rhythmic noise communicates, it sometimes encroaches on all the senses, you know, to send you into thoughts of all kinds, just as poetry does itself.
You know, another thing that's interesting about frogs is that if you walk out to the pond in the night, they'll all of a sudden go dead quiet. I recorded a bunch of them. I used them for a recording project that we did, going out to record them at night. I'd set up the recorder, and while I was doing it, they would be quiet. I would be afraid that they were not going to come back, you know, because they've seen me. They know I'm here. They're afraid I'm going to come and get them, you know. But then they would come back one at a time. You know, you just hear one go.
One of them has a little baton out there that we don't know where it is, or we don't see it, and it taps it, and then all of a sudden they all start up again. Yeah, it's amazing. It's like those murmurings of birds where the big flock seems to be going in one direction and all of a sudden flips and shows the underside of their bodies going in the other. What is it that makes? How do they do that all in concert? It's amazing.
Starlings are really especially good at that. And what's really fun is when there's a windstorm and you see a flock of starlings, and they will just go in one direction and then they'll go in another direction. And I always think that they must find some genuine play. I really love the no hands seagulls in your first poem that you read. You know, I love that because I like riding a bicycle, and I always like that feeling of freedom of putting my hands out to the side and balancing. And so I totally understand. You see crows in a windstorm.
Thank you. But I was really just wanting to have a chance to say on air, whee! How often do you have a chance to say that word? Huh? Well, thank you. Thank you, Steve. It was a really fun-filled conversation we had. This has been David Gilmore with Steve Niebel of the Niebels, and we've been talking about Radio Tacoma's sound poetry.
Thank you, David.
Take care now.